You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Education of Billy Barr by Marie Brenner. William Barr's origin story is, in fact, a parable of how family, education, protest, and principle serve to shape the era and shape a young man who would become America's chief law enforcement officer. At the same time, it is also a narrative about how a charismatic, domineering, and doctrinaire figure named Donald might have helped define the contours of his son's formative years. Garrick Beck never doubted where his friend and high school classmate Billy Barr stood on the question of executive authority. Barr made his views known soon after he came to Horace Mann, then a rigorous all-boys private school in Riverdale, a leafy suburb in the Bronx. It was 1965, and juniors Barr and Beck, due to alphabetical destiny, were once again seated next to each other, this time in American history class. They were 16 years old, privileged boys of their era, their hair neatly brill-creamed, wearing ties and blazers, combs tucked in their back pockets. In class, they were addressed as Mr. Barr and Mr. Beck. As part of their curriculum, they read To Kill a Mockingbird and the Oxbow Incident. In the second semester, they began a line-by-line analysis of the Constitution, using Your Rugged Constitution as a primer. The book's deep dive into the meaning of the document, Barr would later insist, had a profound effect on him. In future histories of the Trump era, Beck will perhaps become a footnote, the accidental witness who first perceived how fiercely Barr believed in the sweeping powers invested in the commander-in-chief. I was left-wing. Billy was right-wing, Beck recalled. Our debates would draw clusters of listeners during lunch. The two teenagers argued at length about the spread of communism, then known as the domino theory. It was the height of the Vietnam War, Beck remembered. Billy would say, if Vietnam would fall, Indonesia would fall, Hawaii would fall. He did not lack for patriotism, and neither did I. I would argue that when we were out there supporting dictators, we were also supporting the heroin smugglers and the totalitarians that had divided America. He would say things like, if you guys get your way, we will be living under the communist flag in no time flat. We sparred constantly, but we respected each other. Turn the lens one way, and they were boys in a time machine of entitlement on a campus of rolling lawns and tennis courts. Turn it another, and they were absorbing the highest ideals of an enlightened education. Barr was the William F. Buckley, Jr. of the class of 1967, a droll outlier who lived in a rambling Riverside Drive apartment with a framed Goldwater for President poster in the foyer. Beck, in contrast, was the first Horace Mann student to wear a peace sign button, and when a teacher forced him to remove it, Beck argued that his right to free speech had been violated. At the time, his parents, Julian Beck, and the actor and director Judith Malina ran the Experimental Living Theater. They fled to Paris after authorities charged them with tax evasion in an attempt to shut down their provocative off-Broadway performance space. Barr's father, Donald, meanwhile, had been part of a circle of Columbia University conservatives and libertarians. The elder Barr, a moderate Republican, became steadily more conservative as the country was polarized by civil upheaval and the tide of youth movement activists who began to look upon authority figures with contempt and suspicion. Donald Barr had recently been appointed headmaster of the progressive Dalton School and was already at odds with a few students and parents who considered him a reactionary who ruled the corridors and classrooms like his own personal fiefdom. Donald Barr was a school headmaster from 1964 to 1986. He died in 2004. I found Garrick Beck at his home, at his house in Santa Fe, more than 50 years after he graduated from Horace Mann. As teenagers, he said, he and his friend Billy debated a subject that has become a touchstone in American politics today. What are the parameters of presidential authority as defined by the founders? Beck had a granular recall of those discussions. What we believed innately was already showing through. We argued about the Constitution as it was reflected in President Lyndon Johnson's treatment of the war. I argued that Johnson did not have the constitutional authority to enact this war. Billy said, all the president needs to declare war is an executive order. That is all. I said, nonsense. The president needs a declaration of war from Congress. I really believe that Billy saw the Constitution as concentrating power in the chairs of the committees and in the cabinet secretaries, the Supreme Court, and the president. Beck and his classmates never doubted Barr's decency. He never cheated on an exam, Beck insisted. He never belittled homosexuals. He never smoked pot behind the gym. When Beck got into trouble for wearing that peace button to class, Barr brought him a gift, a button with a jet bomber depicted inside a peace sign. The caption, drop it. I took it as wit between friends, Beck said. Billy's humor was always there. In the 1967 Horace Mann yearbook, Barr had already been tagged with his future persona, a staunch conservative on political issues, a master of facial contortions, and a brilliant mimic of his Catholic school priest. Often he rode the subway home with another classmate, Barry Scheck, who would become an attorney and eventually co-found the Innocence Project, using DNA evidence to free wrongly convicted prisoners. We would argue all the way down from school and all the way back, Scheck said. Next photo, on the march. Women's rights activist Betty Friedan at a New York City demonstration, 1970. Barr and his three brothers revered their father, spending countless hours at the dinner table discussing philosophy and politics. Before attending Horace Mann, all four siblings had gone to Corpus Christi, a nearby parochial school, where he was in class with many Irish, Hispanic, and black students. William Barr was the privileged son of an intellectual. In first grade, he made a speech in class supporting Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower for president. At age 8, Barr told his parents that he wanted to learn to play the bagpipes. His father not only encouraged him, but located a former Scottish pipes major in the British Army and for years personally escorted his son up to the 168th Street for Tuesday night classes. At one point, the young Barr even declared to his Horace Mann advisor that when he grew up, he wanted to become head of the CIA. Horace Mann was another environment entirely, completely secular, with a large Jewish contingent. A few who knew the Barr boys came to call them the Bully Barrs. The siblings, these former classmates claimed, could be intimidating. The fact that his father was born Jewish was not a factor in Bill Barr's upbringing. While he knew he had Jewish relatives, he never discussed the specifics with his father. He had become more Catholic than the Catholics, he said to those who asked. The school was an enclave of conservative privilege that had educated New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, historian Robert A. Caro, and Cy Newhouse Jr., the late owner of Condé Nast, the parent company of Vanity Fair. The head of the history department, Alfred Briggs, lectured on the evils of communism and Red China, and lavished praise on Horace Mann's most notorious graduate, Roy Cohn. "We need more Roy Cohns in the world," Briggs frequently said. "Roy was my best student of all time." 60s conservatism was often under fire from establishment Republicans on the right and the nascent counterculture on the left. And, as it turned out, the class of 67, my own class as well, would be the last to graduate in the shadow of World War II's silent generation. During Barr's final semester, Johnson ramped up the draft. Muhammad Ali refused a military service. Aretha Franklin released Respect, and Israel won the Six-Day War. As school let out, San Francisco was enveloped by the summer of love. In the face of all this turbulence, Barr went off to Columbia, which erupted his freshman year. The campus strikes and shutdowns, he would later admit, were absolutely crucial in focusing his priorities. When student protest shuttered college buildings, he used the word anarchic to describe the face-off. Furious that the demonstrators, with whom he tangled at the time, were interfering with his ability to enter the library for his classwork in Chinese studies. Soon after graduation, Barr joined the CIA as a China analyst while attending George Washington Law at night and married Christine Moynihan, a librarian. They would raise three daughters, all of whom would become attorneys. A devoted family man, Barr would take a leave from work when his youngest daughter, Meg, had a recurrence of lymphoma, staying with her for months as she was isolated after a stem cell transplant. "Meg's illness changed our family," he told journalist Judith Miller, "and it changed me." Fast forward to 2019. Today, Beck and other classmates are mystified that Barr has appeared to bend time and again, not to some clear-cut legal principle, but to the will of Donald Trump. "I think it is an American tragedy," Beck said. "You start off on one road in life, and you go further and further from where you were, and you lose yourself." Others contend that Barr has ample precedent, operating in the style of a long line of attorneys general: Robert Kennedy, John Mitchell, Alberto Gonzalez, and Eric Holder, who were accused of acting as the president's de facto defender. According to James Zirin, the legal commentator and former federal prosecutor, Barr is from the school of l'état c'est moi, I am the state. A man, in the end, not unlike his father, Donald Barr. Next photo, Biden time. William Barr at his 1991 nomination hearing with Senators Joseph Biden and Patrick Leahy. Last May, Susan Semile was at her country house in Hudson, New York, when she heard a familiar voice drift up the stairs. Decades earlier, Semile, a Dalton School graduate, had been hired by Donald Barr to teach social studies and remained for 25 years. She is now a professor at City College. The sound coming from the Senate hearings pulled her toward the TV. It was a voice that she had lived with for a generation. "The tone of overknowing moral superiority, that is what I heard," she said. She came downstairs to see William Barr, as rumpled and stern as his father had once been, with the same granite expression that had vexed her during her early teaching career. "You seem to have been the designated fall guy," Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Connecticut Democrat, said to Barr, "History will judge you harshly." His face remained impervious. His reaction and his voice were so similar, it was eerie, Samil remembered. I immediately thought, this is Donald Barr. He has the same glasses. He was trying to turn the clock back in time, just like his father once did. He was the Danish king, Canute, trying to hold back the waves. The same tone, the way he moved, Samil went on, pondering the impact of the Attorney General's relationship with two father figures. Donald Barr and Donald Trump, the same chaotic style of management and rule by ukase. I thought immediately, this man cares deeply about his place in history. Billy has a score to settle. That day, Dalton graduates began to message one another through their Facebook pages. Can you effing believe this? Are we back in high school? For some in this group of professionals in their 60s, long removed from the terrors of high school, Barr's appearance triggered curiously primal memories. At home in Pomona, New York, the filmmaker Jonathan Sloan was listening to New York Public Radio's Brian Lehrer show when the host asked a guest, "Who is William Barr?" "I threw a book at the radio," Sloan told me. In London, the psychologist Anne Plachette Murphy, a Dalton grad, tuned in. The apple does not always fall far from the tree. Barr could have gone through life in opposition to his father, but you could not have watched him at the Senate and not thought, this is Donald Barr. In Brooklyn, book editor Sarah Crichton said she went into spasms when she saw Barr testify, remembering the moment the headmaster called an assembly and decried the women students who were seeking permission to wear slacks to class. The rule was that you could not wear pants unless it was below 20 degrees outside, she said. Mr. Barr stood up and told the assembled high school, "Your desire to wear slacks is masturbatory ego gratification." Dalton, a tall, narrow red brick building situated then as now at the corner of Park Avenue and 89th Street, had always attracted the sons and daughters of artists and the elite professional class, drawn to its unusual style of education that is focused on creativity. As Bill Barr started his sophomore year at Horace Mann High School in 1964, his father was hired to up the standards at Dalton, a school started in 1919 by the experimental educator Helen Parkhurst. Among her innovations, no bells to single class changes, no bells to signal class changes, individual labs set to the student's own pace. Barr was brought in to put Dalton on the map, Samil recalled. Many people thought he was a genius and a madman. The school was going nowhere. Barr was installed to give it a mandate. Plachette Murphy explained, "The values in the 1960s were not about money. They were trying to educate the next Jackson Pollocks." Dalton parent Jacob Javits, at the time a Republican senator from New York, came to Samil's fifth grade class to talk about his experience growing up. So did Dalton parent Norman Potteritz, editor of the left-leaning commentary magazine, who by the 1970s would transform into a leading neocon. How better to teach 10-year-olds than to have them hear how the best and the brightest had learned to use cutlery at Schrafts? The student body would be made up of the children of Saul Bellow, Bob Fosse, Neil Simon, Robert Redford, Elia Kazan, Richard Avedon, as well as Rockefellers, Whitneys, and heads of television networks and Lincoln Center. The actors Wallace Shawn, Tracy Ellis Ross, and Claire Danes attended too. So did comedian Chevy Chase and author Frances Fitzgerald. In 1979, Woody Allen, whose son Moses Farrow was a student, used the exterior of Dalton to film the scene from Manhattan in which Isaac, played by the 42-year-old Allen, tries to seduce the 17-year-old Tracy, played by Mariel Hemingway. Next photo, odd couple. President Trump and his attorney general at a White House news conference in July. I heard the name Donald Barr for the first time in 1972. New to New York, I worked as an assistant in the story department at Paramount. My boss, an ardent feminist, was a Dalton mother and sympathetic to an effort by parents to force Barr out of his job. In 1971, New York Magazine had run a story, The Parents' Revolt at Dalton, and it opened with an account of a Dalton PTA meeting at which an insurance executive gets punched. An accompanying cartoon showed Barr using a large contraption to eject unruly students. At issue was his high-handed tactics and the school's power struggles, against the backdrop of an America imploding over the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and the policies of Richard Nixon. Anyone caught smoking pot, even off campus, was ousted. He was one of the people standing in the way of a cultural tidal wave he did not understand, recalled a Dalton student from that era, Mark Edelman, now a professor of anthropology at Hunter College. The uproar was my first exposure to the hysteria that can overcome private school parents. It represented a new language for me, having come from a public high school in San Antonio, where the rules were more or less the same as those Barr was trying to impose. The language of the cave dwellers intrigued me, the Horace Mann versus Dalton differences, and seemed as remote as the caste brandings of the Brahmins of Varanasi. The ability to say, I am a Dalton parent, had a special cachet in the 1970s, implying that you were part of a strata of infinite varieties, as New York phrased it, a member of the media elite and our crowd, Jewish society, with a few social register WASP, downtown lefties, and Columbia intellectuals thrown into the mix. These parents were determined to have a major say in how their children's school was run. By accident, I had stumbled upon a rarefied war that had pitted a headstrong headmaster against the parents and students of Dalton, who were attempting to react to the cultural revolution that had upended the country. Barr's dress codes, Popinjay snobberies, and Eisenhower-era dictates had the place up in arms. Blue jeans are for the working class, he told a group of students who wanted to wear them with their blazers. We are elites, and we do not train anyone here to be working class. At first, Barr had seemed an enlightened choice. The son of an economist and psychologist, he had attended New York's progressive Lincoln School in the 1930s, and, in the style of the era, was a Marxist, then a fierce anti-communist after World War II. Lincoln was a Valhalla of intellect, where John D. Rockefeller Jr. sent his own children to learn with the new John Dewey principles, which were geared toward each child's own strengths. During the war, Barr joined the OSS, forerunner to the CIA, and later taught English at Columbia, was an associate dean in the engineering school, and ran a weekend program for gifted high school science students. Barr, never shy about his accomplishments, would boast that he had published reviews of 250 books, principally for the New York Times Book Review. When asked about his religion, he said he was an atheist, and insisted that he be addressed as Dr. Barr, though, according to the Times, he had never completed his Ph.D. His wife, Mary, an observant Catholic, had a degree from Yale, taught at Columbia, and was an editor at Redbook. Barr was an innovator. He believed that the best teachers did not come out of teachers' colleges and thought that the Columbia Education Building should be blown up, Samil recalled. Another former student noted, I mentioned to him once that I wanted to learn Japanese. The next week, there was a Japanese tutor. The school at one time offered 14 languages. And despite being a disciplinarian, he generally welcomed a variety of perspectives. My father was pretty strong on encouraging opposing viewpoints, William Barr would later confide to a co-worker, as long as they were peacefully expressed and not impinging on others. Donald Barr was a guest on the popular David Susskind show and was profiled in the New York Times Magazine. In the 60s, while New York private schools still had implicit Jewish quotas, Dalton, largely Jewish, was decidedly inclusive. There were students of color and students with disabilities, Samil said. In the press, Barr crowed that Dalton students had pizzazz. In short order, the headmaster managed to double Dalton's enrollment and, according to the Times, made it among the most desirable schools in the city, rebranding an institution that, despite its stellar history, had been fading in allure. For his teaching staff, Barr brought in photographers, white Russian aristocrats, anti-Castro Cuban grandees, and a group of gifted college dropouts, including one Jeffrey Epstein, a charismatic teacher who had skipped several years in high school. Epstein often walked through school wearing a long fur coat. One former Dalton School student who knew Epstein remembered, it was a time in New York, the 70s, when everyone was sleeping with everyone. Several of the teachers were openly carrying on with students, and they would go to parties together. Jeffrey Epstein was the least of it. Epstein, the financier, was later convicted of sex crimes. When he hanged himself in a federal prison this past August, while awaiting new sex trafficking charges, it was William Barr, overseer of the federal prison system, who immediately called for an investigation. Barr recently claimed he hadn't made the Dalton-Epstein connection until he read about it in the press. Donald Barr, it turned out, was no Mr. Chips. He was a remote presence, according to alumni. Early on, his time was taken up recruiting boys for the upper school. I was considering going off to boarding school, recalled Stephen Sloan, Jonathan Sloan's brother, now the editorial director of the Saturday Evening Post. I went up to visit Andover. Meanwhile, my parents went to meet with Donald Barr. He said, don't send Steve there. There are a lot of homosexuals who prey on boys there. My parents laughed it off. Nonetheless, Sloan stayed at Dalton, and during his freshman year, Barr called an assembly to decry an episode in which two boys had been found having sex. I remember how outraged he was, and said to all of us, this disgusting, horrible thing has happened. Unnatural acts were performed. When college admissions time rolled around, however, Barr was an ardent defender of his students, frequently traveling to campuses to meet admissions counselors on behalf of Dalton's top prospects. Part of the draw of Dalton was the implicit promise that the school's most accomplished graduates would likely move on to an Ivy League education. Donald Barr was self-conscious about class differences, Samil contended. He often talked about the Columbia Mafia, the world he had come out of, and the rich Upper East Side families. There was a battle going on between the old money German Jewish values of Dalton and the new money that had come in. The clash of cultures was inevitable. A libertarian turned conservative Republican, Barr wore an American flag pin on his lapel and cared deeply about credentials. In his writings and conversations, He could sound ponderous. He would cite the First Vatican Council, parse the subtleties of dialectical materialism, or quote the Victorian novelist and critic G.K. Chesterton on the relevance of understanding history. And he never made a secret of his passion for rigid adherence to rules, to the notion that good discipline instilled moral backbone in individuals and society at large. In Barr's 1971 book, Who Pushed Humpty Dumpty?, he noted, "I had a sense that there was to be a crisis of discipline. To the modern liberal mind, the word has an almost pornographic sound, but discipline is necessary to freedom. Though discipline and freedom seem antithetical, each without the other destroys itself. In government, order without dissent stagnates, and rebellion without law makes chaos, and both are despotic." Barr had tense standoffs with Dalton parents who either disagreed with his politics or took issue with his management style or brusque personality. He could be peevish and small-minded as he identified enemies, real or imagined. He could also be impulsive, Samil remembered. You would go into your mailbox in the morning, and there would be a directive, and at 3 p.m., there would be another memo telling you to put the original policy back in place. William Barr was still in high school as trouble started to swirl around his father. Even though the elder Barr had supporters on the Dalton board, it was apparent that the headmaster and his antagonist had begun to take up their positions. And then things started to get ugly. On the day last June, when William Barr was first threatened with contempt of Congress charges for his refusal to respond to subpoenas related to the Mueller investigation, I phoned Jonathan Ferdan. He was in his car driving across the Chesapeake Bay. Ferdan is an architectural engineer and a senior partner in a major Philadelphia construction company, a career that almost never came to pass. Private schools in New York have never been democratic citadels. In the 60s and 70s, and for nearly a generation after, elite institutions of higher learning routinely filled a disproportionate share of slots with students from privileged, competitive bastions like Dalton. And at no time was their complicated favor system more apparent than during the college application crunch, when the raised eyebrow of a headmaster could sway the chances of even the most promising student. In this environment, what happened to Ferdan, a straight-A class president with near-perfect college board scores, was astonishing, even by New York standards. Low-key and polite, Ferdan was one of three siblings to go to Dalton. "When my family first met Barr," he told me, "he was still running the Columbia program. My older brother Daniel, who was really brilliant, he's a physicist today, was part of his Columbia gifted science program. When Daniel decided that higher education did not necessarily suit him, Barr lured him to Dalton to teach. It was considered a coup for Barr when Betty Friedan, the pioneering feminist, chose to send her other kids to Dalton." Friedan's seminal study of the Housewives of America, The Feminine Mystique, had recently set off a revolution among middle-class women in America. Often on TV, she had a confrontational style that some considered abrasive, but her intellect was formidable. In 1968, Jonathan Friedan's sophomore year at Dalton, Columbia students began what turned out to be a wave of protest, and the campus shut down. Friedan was sympathetic to their cause. Part of a group of four Dalton friends who were high achievers and the school's most committed activist, he was adamant in his opposition to the Vietnam War, which placed him in the crosshairs of the headmaster. These Dalton students' most vocal supporters were their parents, including Betty Friedan, whose public personality grated on Barr. One of the four friends was Stephen Sloan, later the class valedictorian. Along with Jonathan Friedan and classmates Mark Edelman and Dan Friedman, Sloan helped mobilize many Dalton students to political action. Their meetings typically took place at the Friedan's townhouse on East 93rd Street. The four remain close friends. Friedan, the most diplomatic of the group, was deputized to negotiate with Barr. "Our first action came when we were sophomores," he remembered. "It was a sympathy high school strike after Martin Luther King was killed and Columbia shut down. There were riots all over the city, including one in front of Dalton. Barr was furious," recalled Edelman, "and he yelled at Jonathan for disrespecting the school by encouraging impressionable kids to follow the lead of older college-age rebels who were engaging in acts of civil disobedience." "There were two issues which really sent him into orbit," Edelman continued, "the dress codes and the Vietnam War." All through high school, the Gang of Four battled with Barr on these and other issues. As riots continued to seethe at Columbia and across the country, Dalton's student activist spoke out in support, sometimes joining the marchers. In the fall of their senior year, the Vietnam War moratorium was announced, a massive demonstration that was to be held in Washington, D.C. At that very moment, seniors Friedan and Sloan were busy trying to meet their college application deadlines, a fact that did not escape Barr's attention. "Just as everyone was going nuts around the country, so too were we," said Sloan. "From the ninth grade, we were the group who was anti-war. Barr opposed our going to demonstrations or having time off, and was opposed to any leftist public display of anti-war materials." The year before, Barr had made it clear how livid he was about the Columbia riots. His son William had been a freshman there, and in a column for Vogue, the elder Barr decried the middle-class students who go to demonstrations by taxi, dismissing the protest of Columbia's radical Students for a Democratic Society and their opposition to a quasi-segregated gym the university wanted to build in Harlem. Donald Barr expressed his rage in print, noting that he was frightened of the anarchy and the mob tactics of the new left, as well as their moves at Columbia to try to stop ROTC funding from going to national defense. "Parents," he wrote in a McCall's essay, "are directly financing the new left revolution and the drug cop-out, and indirectly they are supporting the black militants." At the height of the Black Power movement, Barr came out against the black militants, who are tired of asking for a little share and are going to take a big share of Whitey's good life and education. Barr's opposition to the chaos wrought by the protesters was echoed by his son. "Our next-door neighbor in our building was the acting president of Columbia," William Barr would later tell an acquaintance. "He tried to take a tough stand and came under a lot of pressure from the attackers. I felt if the leaders had taken a stronger stance up front, it would not have degenerated so much. That year, 1968, was formative for me." The draft lottery, announced in 1969, had traumatized families with sons in college, including the Barrs. "Billy's mother told me how upset she was that he might be going to war," Samil remembered. "It was a time of body bags and students moving to Canada," Friedan said. Friedman, the editor of the Daltonian in 1970, tangled with the headmaster over the political slant of the school paper. "We had called for a strike in support of the moratorium," Friedman said. "I was called into Barr's office, and he began to read me my college recommendation. This was before I applied. 'Danny is not such an exemplary student, but he is a real leader, Barr read in a tone that was both condescending and menacing. I pushed back and said he could threaten me, but I wasn't calling off the strike. Then I ran out of his office and found the social studies teacher. I cried in his arms. I was that upset. I would be called in periodically by Headmaster Barr, Edelman remembered. I would be interrogated about any number of things. I was having to constantly remind him that students had constitutional rights. There was a constant monitoring of our student press and of outside activities that involved going to demonstrations or organizing for demonstrations. One time, at the end of a harangue, he said, "Well, Mark, I would rather have a little linen like you than some of these little Timothy Learys we have got here." That was his way of saying that I was pretty terrible, but at least I didn't seem to be a big druggie. In November, Fredan and his friends took off for the Vietnam War moratorium, sleeping on church floors. When they came back, Barr was uncharacteristically quiet. Their college applications were in the mail. Fredan and Sloan had assumed that as A students with superior SATs, they would have their choice of schools in the Ivy League. Their parents had been under the same impression. But how naive could they have been? It was a moment in America when colleges, worried about campus unrest, carefully vetted applications for would-be agitators. What's more, Betty Friedan was a vocal member of a group of Dalton parents who were trying to have Barr dismissed. In April, Jonathan Friedan, who had applied to 8 schools, was rejected from each and every one, including his safety choices. Sloan, the valedictorian, was admitted only to Swarthmore and one of his safety schools. The Sloans and the Friedans immediately suspected Barr had sabotaged the boys' applications, flagging their sons as agitators who had incited their peers. "I was in shock," Friedan recalled, and Barr immediately called me into his office. He read me a glowing recommendation letter. The first thing he said was, "It wasn't me." Had Barr felt remorse? Did he worry about his own liability or the school's, and therefore want to deflect possible legal action? My mother worried that it was her fault, that her big opinions and personality had frightened the colleges. It was a traumatic period. My parents were going through a divorce, and my father wanted to sue Dalton. One of Friedan's extracurricular activities had involved organizing an anti-drug program affiliated with Columbia. That summer, the university agreed to admit him, and though he attended for 2 semesters, he dropped out, thrown off his axis by what had happened to him at Dalton. He spent what he called a few wandering years, working as a carpenter and a commercial fisherman in the Pacific Northwest. It was a blessing in a way, he told me. I was able to confront life without the scrim of all the privilege I had grown up with. Later, Friedan went back to Columbia, where he finished his engineering degree, but his mother was determined to find out what happened. A Harvard trustee somehow was able to penetrate the admissions office. "At least, this is what my mother told me," Friedan said. Betty Friedan died in 2006, and what he discovered was shocking. There was a long letter Barr had written accusing me of being a rabble-rouser and a troublemaker. He said I was a latent homosexual and could be a danger to the school. Years later, while working on a biography of Betty Friedan, writer Judith Hennessy confronted Barr about his possible role in her son's college rejections. At first, he denied it. Then he admitted that, in fact, he had had some input that was laudatory. Jonathan Friedan, looking back at the exchange between Hennessy and Barr, felt that Barr was trying to suggest that it was Betty who had made all the trouble, meddling in the admissions offices. "But my mother," Calling 8 admissions offices? Out of the question. Stories about the alleged sabotage circulated within the Dalton community. But by then, many of the parents, board members, and alumni had had enough. The man who had brought such prestige and robust innovation to Dalton had become insular, autocratic, and tone-deaf to the competing needs of the stakeholders in the school. It took Dalton parent Richard Ravitch, a real estate titan who later became the head of the city's transit authority, to devise a strategy to get Barr out. Ravitch, the head of the trustees, polled the parents and teachers and discovered, he would tell me, a pattern of behavior that was troubling. I came on to run the board after Barr had won the right to stay at the school by a single vote. Many on the board resigned over it. The teachers hated him. The parents disliked him. Barr at the time was backed by at least one influential trustee, a sympathetic litigator who challenged the bylaws of the school, discovering a loophole that allowed him a seat on the board. The mandate of the PTA was taken away. There were legal maneuvers meant to call into question the very authority of the board. This actually went to court, Ravitch recalled. The head of the PTA was in favor of Barr, and they litigated. Did the PTA have the right to impeach the PTA president? The courts said, yes, they did. There were frequent screaming matches at PTA meetings, Sarah Crichton said. One night, Samil recalled, all of these well-mannered parents were stomping their feet and pounding the floor. Ravitch recounted the denouement. I brought in the dean of the Harvard School of Education and the head of Teachers College to evaluate Barr. They came back and said that Barr was not the right headmaster for Dalton. It was a humiliating end to Barr's years at the school. I fired him. It took years to get him out, but we did it. Barr, as part of an arrangement, announced his resignation. The Dalton yearbook, Playing Nice, had this to say, the whole of Dalton owes a great debt to Donald Barr. We are all greatly saddened by his leaving. Barr found a new job running Hackley, a more conservative private school in Westchester County. In an interview with the New York Times, he said, kids up here are better-natured and less bitchy. It was a relief, Barr insisted, to be liberated from the ego display and radical chic of private school kids in Manhattan. William Barr was very much aware of the Dalton scandal. His father's concerted campaign to save his job was covered widely in the Times and elsewhere. One can only speculate how much this saga affected Bill Barr in later life, or helped solder his father-son fealty. Soon after Donald Barr left Dalton, he surprised many who knew him by publishing Space Relations, an odd sci-fi novel, which imagined the Kingdom of Kosar, a hellscape where power, drugs, and boredom have turned the ruling caste into vicious sexual predators. The hero, John Craig, a rising young Earth diplomat who is captured and enslaved, eventually triumphs, restoring virginity and monogamy to the colonized. William Barr recently confided to an associate that he has never read the book, even as he pointed out that it was part of his father's personality to be a renegade, often using earthy phrases to provoke, such as the sneeze of the genitals. Barr was also said to have noted that of all the lessons he learned from his father, the most overriding one was the fierce pride he took in being a contrarian. Barr would later tell one colleague, my father once said to me that we have been used to being different, and it doesn't bother us at all. I have always been in situations where I had no problem being politically different. I don't govern my life by polls or by what other people think about what I do. Indeed, this, then, is the same Bill Barr who once argued that President Johnson, not Congress, had the overriding authority to determine the military course of America's involvement in the Vietnam War. 20 years later, during the Iran-Contra crisis that rocked Ronald Reagan's second term, Barr, then a White House policy advisor, voiced the view that administration members should be granted pardons for their roles in the ill-fated Arms for Hostages deal. As Assistant Attorney General and then AG under George H.W. Bush, Barr pushed back against a proposed independent probe of Bush insiders, earning the epithet Cover-Up General Barr. In June 2018, he wrote a voluminous memo, unsolicited, that made the case that as chief executive, Donald Trump, if he had not committed crimes, should not be investigated for obstructing justice. President Bill Clinton's impeachment had been warranted, in Barr's estimation, because Clinton had violated the law. Then, after Trump appointed Barr as Attorney General, his stiff-arm summary of the Mueller report was firm and categorical and consistent with his past stances. He cast aside the nuanced findings of the special counsel and declared that even if the Russian government had tampered with the U.S. presidential election, the nation's chief executive and his team had basically been cleared of any complicity or wrongdoing. And finally, Trump's depiction of Barr and Rudy Giuliani as his personal envoys, as described in the whistleblower's account, appears to be the coup de grace. The president, characterizing his attorney general and personal lawyer as conduits for foreign governments, assisting Trump against his political enemies. For Barr's schoolmate, Garrick Beck, there is no question how much Alfred Briggs, Horace Mann's high school history teacher, would have approved of Trump's Justice Department, which has seen defections of career federal lawyers who have refused to serve at the whims of a truculent president who publicly defies the rule of law, spews racist tropes, and shatters judicial norms. It was Briggs, after all, who was known to say, "We need more Roy Cohns in the world." One statement of Barr's from the 1990s bears repeating here. After a stint as George H.W. Bush's Attorney General, Barr participated in the Miller Center's oral history of the administration. At one point, he spoke eloquently about the president that he and his cohorts had served, someone they considered to be a man of honor, a man of character, and a man they were actually proud to have as the president. One can only wonder, does he now feel the same about his tenure with Donald J. Trump? Dan Friedman remembered an encounter he'd had 20 years after he'd graduated from high school, the day he met William Barr, who was then George H.W. Bush's head of the White House Office of Legal Counsel. At the time, Friedman was reporting for Hearst newspapers. Barr, he recalled, had already written a famous legal memo asserting that presidents could not be indicted. I thought, this is Donald Barr's son. I walked in to interview him, and I said, "Your father was my enemy, and we fought each other tooth and nail." He deadpanned and said, "I hope that won't influence your coverage of the Justice Department." He was a straight shooter, and I respected him. The two would interact from time to time. Barr was once Friedman's guest at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. When he was appointed by Trump, I thought, "Trump isn't getting the person he thought he was getting," said Friedman, who respected Barr's sincerity and his consistent positions on issues of law. "Now, I am not sure what to think." Friedman shared one final memory. On the day in 1991 that William Barr was sworn in as Attorney General, Friedman was invited to the ceremony. There, he encountered Donald Barr, then in his 70s. It was the first time he had seen him since their Dalton days. Enough time had gone by, Friedman recalled. I went up to him and shook his hand. I said, "You must be very proud of your son." He looked at me and said, "I am very proud that all the things I stood for have come to fruition. Now the executive branch has finally embraced my way of thinking." It was clear to me that Donald Barr felt completely vindicated. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.